this is one, to my estimation, at least one of the most accomplished human beings on Earth. Not only was he the last person to walk on the moon and the only trained professional geologist to go to the moon, but if that were not enough, he became a U.S. senator, and he's been a successful businessman as well. Having been there myself, I think the third one is almost as challenging as the first two put together. At dinner last night, I reminded Harrison that we had a conversation about 20 years ago, also at a dinner in Boston, about dust, and his comments about this very unique material stuck in my mind all these years. And when it came time to put together this workshop, there was really no question in my mind as to who I wanted to be the keynote speaker. Unlike Mars, we're extremely fortunate to have people who are actually on the moon and have experienced firsthand the effects of lunar regolith dust. This is a precious scientific resource, and we should take great advantage of it in the planning for the exploration vision, and take advantage of specifically Harrison's geological expertise and the vivid firsthand recollections that he has. So I'd like to introduce you Apollo 17 pilot and our keynote speaker, Harrison Schmidt.
Thank you very much, Russ. I really appreciate that. Can I control it here? It's just that you're going to be punching it a lot. I learned, my friends at Wisconsin taught me how to automate PowerPoint presentations, and I've gone wild with it. At least it makes it a little bit easier. Okay, good. Does this light come on? Probably not. Anyway, first of all, would like to thank Russ and everyone else involved in this conference for putting it together. As you can see, it's been a matter of some interest to a lot of us for many, many years, beginning with my first whiff of dust on the moon and the old comment that all of us made, it smells like it's been gunpowder, and it does. One thing I would say in beginning is try to be positive. There will be a tendency, I think, to be pessimistic about things we don't understand. Well, let's just remember, we can understand them and we can find ways to deal with it. I think that's has always been the attitude we've had for space programs, and I think we should continue it. There has been a tendency, particularly in NASA, but also nationwide and maybe worldwide, to become risk averse. The comment about strip mining the moon is an example of that. If you're going to use lunar resources, you're going to have to mine those resources. It's not something that it can be avoided, but it's also something that won't ever be seen from Earth. We can talk about that at some other time. But risk, if you're too risk averse, you're not going to go. I happen to be co-chairman of the, it'll take me a minute here to get this, of the Human Planetary Landings Systems Capability Roadmap Group. Rob Manning of JPL and I are running that. And some of the things we have found out, it would be easy to be pessimistic about our ability to land on Mars. Decelerating a 40 metric ton payload in the Mars atmosphere is not a task we really understand how to do right now. But I think everybody on the group's optimistic that we'll figure that out. A final introductory comment would be that as you put major milestones together, think of them in terms of young generational increments, because it's the young people that are going to have to be excited about those milestones and make sure that they happen. Never forget, Apollo was a young person's program. The average age of people in Mission Control Center during Apollo 13 was 26 years. Average age. They'd already been there a number of years, just out of engineering school. You just got to remember, that's how it's going to happen. It's going to happen with those young people. And so your milestones have to take that into account. Since about 10 years, plus or minus a couple years, is probably the limit that people can work their 16-hour days, seemingly 8-day weeks, to make these kind of things happen. Not exactly the dust conference issues, but I think very, very important. Now, you may be wondering why we're not at the Ames campus. I just was informed this morning that there was a mountain lion inside it, and I guess they're trying to protect us. Okay, the Apollo experience. The regolith is the key to that experience. That's what we have to understand. It disturbed. Whoops. Other side. We'll go back one. The disturbed regolith in this picture, after a couple of EVAs, you can see that in spite of the fact it has extremely high bearing strength to begin with, it does get disturbed. Fortunately, there's no atmosphere, unlike Mars. And when you scuff it, it just goes over in a parabolic trajectory and hits the surface, and it's not a problem. It does gradually accumulate on the suit. I think that if we could have stayed upright the entire time, we wouldn't have gotten nearly so dirty as we did. But you don't worry about falling in a 1/6 gravity environment. And so we fell a lot, and we got very dirty. more on that in a moment. But as you work, this material does get softer and softer, and so stabilization of that material will be important on the at least the long-duration missions. But also, there's lots of aggregate. The original macadam was just aggregate, and you can see it out here on the surface. And one of the byproducts of resource utilization will be the availability of a great deal of aggregate for surface stabilization. There are also opportunities for possible microwave sintering and lunar concrete and things like that, which we won't get into, I don't think, here today. Now, the only weathering erosional agents on the moon, by the way, some of these slides, the more fancy, colorful ones, are the courtesy of Professor Larry Taylor, who put them together for a different purpose, a different conference, and I'm using a few of those in this presentation. Taylor is at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And the only weathering erosional agents on the moon are meteorite, meteorite impact, and the solar wind. And the basic processes, commutation, breaking of rocks, minerals, and glasses into ever smaller particles, that's what produces our dust. Agglutination tends to minimize the amount. It becomes more and more important over time. The welding of rocks, minerals, and glass fragments together with this impact-produced glass. Impact melted vaporization and deposition occurs at the locus of each micrometeor impact. You have extraordinarily high temperatures. Plasmas are generated. You get and redeposition of that material. Some of it will be lost and actually even entrained into the solar wind, but most of it is redeposited primarily as a silica alumina rich glass on the surface of all particles. Talk more about that in a moment. Some of those volatiles, by the way, will gradually migrate towards the poles. And I am one of the skeptics on ice. Certainly there is increased hydrogen at the poles, but that's almost certainly mostly solar wind hydrogen. Because that is what we already know is there, and as it migrates slowly over 4 billion years, it's going to accumulate in the regolith at the poles in the colder regions and in the cold traps provided by permanent shadow. The solar wind spallation and particle implantation is relatively minor in terms of its impact on weathering, extraordinarily important long-term relative to resources on the moon. And particularly, as you all, many of you know, my primary interest these days is in the energy resources presented by helium-3. Now, space weathering, the cumulative effects due to deep vacuum, 10 to the minus 12 torr, you've got to keep that in mind. All of the material on the lunar surface has been produced by grinding in a 10 to the minus 12 torr vacuum. We don't have that experience here on Earth, and we probably can't even create it at this time. It is a challenge, something that we should think about in terms of developing at least small amounts of stimulant, is to be able to recreate that kind of commutation in that kind of a vacuum. Now, there's another process going on that will be even tougher to recreate, and we'll talk about that more in a moment. The micrometeor impact or velocities in excess of 10 to the 5th kilometers per hour, very energetic. On Mars, of course, you have at least some atmosphere, and from the standpoint of creation of an impact-generated regolith, as we know it on the moon, that doesn't occur on Mars. The dust is being produced by other processes. primarily on Mars. Mars, as I suggested earlier, has just enough atmosphere to be a problem and not enough to help you very much in deceleration. It's an issue that we're dealing with in our capabilities roadmap group. Solar wind particles, galactic and cosmic, do alter and accumulate in the lunar regolith. And of course, you have these extraordinary temperature variations over time. Interestingly enough, because of the absence of water in the lunar regolith, for the most part, except possibly the deep craters in the polar regions, that those temperature variations don't contribute to weather. You do see seismically a little bit of a temperature dependence in the seismic signals that you from the surface, but not a lot. It is not nearly the important process as it is here on Earth and probably on Mars as well. This is just a quick schematic to give you an idea of how regolith will be generated, and the mixing happens pretty rapidly. Just with a few craters, you start to get significant mixing of the lunar materials, and of course this continues down to smaller and smaller sizes. And as you get down to micrometeorites, the commutation, agglutination, and vapor deposition occurs at a much smaller scale, with glass being one of the products and the formation of agglutinates as another. The major weather and erosional agent on the moon is this micrometeorite impact. Now, quickly summarizing, we've got an incompatibility of automation here, so I'll spell them out on the slide. It's that regolith that Shoemaker described it back after Surveyor, and anticipated even before Surveyor. It was a battle of fragmental, unconsolidated material that's overlying the bedrock of the moon. Doesn't want to. There we go. Spell it out now. In the Mare Tranquillitatis area, and in areas in basaltic Mare of that age, around 3.8 billion years, it's going to average about 6 meters deep. And below that, pretty sharp transition, that you're going to find blocks, broken blocks of rock. The bedrock will be there. But above that, it's this pretty much uniformly mixed regolith. The constituents, rock fragments, mineral fragments, volcanic glass spheres, and fragments, even before we discovered the orange soil, the orange pyroclastic glass on Apollo 17, and later realized that we had a nice sample from Apollo 15 as well, of green volcanic glass, it had been recognized that little tiny spheres of volcanic glass exist in all the soil samples that were taken on the moon. I think that even includes, correct me if I'm wrong, even includes Apollo 16, small spheres of volcanic glass. So pyroclastic eruptions were occurring essentially everywhere, at least on the front side of the moon, and have been incorporated in the regolith. Fragments of that glass, and the glass itself, is one of the components of dust. At the Apollo 17 site, it is a major component of the lunar regolith. The agglutinates, this is the where things have been welded together by impact glass. They get more and more abundant with age. You'll see figures illustrating that in a minute. Meteoritic contamination is small. In fact, since this slide was produced, I think that number has even gone down as people have looked at the iridium concentration and the regolith and other components. There's just not much there. When objects impact the moon at 15 to 20 kilometers per second, they vaporize, there's not much, very little of it is reincorporated in the lunar surface. Now, Mars, of course, we've already found a meteorite, so again, the atmosphere of Mars will tend to produce more meteoritic contamination, and it's part of the dust. The absorbed solar wind volatiles are very important from a resource point of view, not particularly critical in terms of dust properties because of the small concentration that's there. The products of solar and cosmic radiation we've already mentioned. The Lateral mixing rate, just very quickly, it's on the order of tens of meters per 100 million years, hundreds of meters per billion years, at least since 3.8 billion years ago. Things were somewhat different prior to that time, and the mixing rate was probably much higher. Vertical mixing is irregular, but the 3-meter core drills, cores that we've taken on the moon, do indicate that in spite of the textural layering that you see from superposed impact blankets, crater blankets, there's no significant average chemical change at depth. There's a lot of irregularity, but as you go down, you see that you can't see any trend, at least in 3 meters. Well, next. There we go, try one more. The geotechnical parameters, the engineering design constraints, if you will, are important. David Carrier, of course, is part of the group that Larry Taylor and I work with, and James Carter and others have put these kinds of things together. Why this is being difficult. What am I supposed to do? Okay. The density, vary 1.7, 1.9 grams per cubic centimeter, very closely packed material. High bearing strength, closely packed material. Again, remember, in addition to the micrometeorites creating a large part of the dust, they tamp the surface. And over a long period of time, everything gets into a position so that it's very closely packed. Next. High bearing strength. Next. Low cohesion. If you imagine damp beach sand, a little bit of water, damp beach sand, you have a little bit of water around each grain, and that tends to give you some cohesion. On the moon, of course, you don't have that. You have unsatisfied electron bonds because of this commutation in a high vacuum. But the cohesion is similar. It clumps. It shows a nice footprint, fortunately, for a lot of great photographs. That's the best analogy that I can give you next. Now, 60% of the particles are less than 100, that should be microns. Somehow the symbol would get transferred. And it's very penetrating, extremely penetrating. Just imagine a graphite lubricant, but something that doesn't have any lubricating properties at all. Next. And it's highly abrasive. That is, for all moving parts, you're going to have reliable seals in order to avoid that abrasion. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Next. It's disseminated fine-grained native iron. More on that in a moment. Next. And there's also, remember, fine-grained iron sulfide. Not very much, but some. And so when you're working at with the lunar regolith at temperatures in excess of about 900 degrees C, you're going to generate not only some water, as the hydrogen reacts with minerals in the regolith, but you're going to generate some sulfuric acid. So you'll want to maintain your temperatures below the decomposition temperatures of iron sulfide. Next. It's highly reducing. Not only hydrogen, but carbon is present, both of them from the solar wind. Next. At the millimeter scale, this is what you see. The impact glass beads are distinct from the volcanic beads in terms of their morphologies. There are glutenates and rock chips and mineral chips and alike. Some plagioclase, even, that's the calcium aluminum silicate, and we'll see that again in a moment. Oops, sorry. Now, over measuring maturity in terms of the parameter of IS over FeO content, IS being a magnetic susceptibility. What's a good definition of that, Dave? Is there one word?
Ferromagnetic resonance.
And you see agglutinates are increasing in concentration while minerals and rock fragments are decreasing over time. Next. The agglutinates in all the samples show an increase with decreasing size. very important parameter. Just to illustrate, in the high titanium mare, you see more pyroclastic glass, at least with Apollo 17 samples, and hydrogen and helium are present in the ilmenite, concentrated in the ilmenite. The evidence is very clear that a large proportion of your solar wind hydrogen and helium are retained in the ilmenite rather than in the other minerals. Now, one problem there is a paper that I had presented for me, since I couldn't get there due to snow and raton, at the Colorado School of Mines conference, the Resources Roundtable conference. I think you can show very clearly that you're losing a lot, you've lost a lot of solar wind molecules out of the samples due to agitation. From the point of sample to the point of measurement in the laboratory, these samples have been handled a great deal. And it looks like possibly almost as much as 50% of the solar wind molecules have been lost due to that agitation. Next. Down at the 100 micron level, this is an agglutinate, a mixture of all sorts of everything in the regolith cemented together by glass, pictured courtesy of our one of our later speakers, Dave McKay. Next. And in polished section, you start to see some of the more metallic minerals, the iron sulfides, as well as native iron. Next slide. And the glass, the shape of the glass shards also shows up here. That's a vesicle with very clear outlines. Next slide. And down at the 1 micron level, you can start to pick up at submicron some of the nanophase iron. Nanophase iron, these are extraordinarily small particles of iron, and talk more about that in just a moment. Next. The distribution of these small metal spheres in agglutinated glass, the Apollo 11 sample, the 10084 sample that's so important to us, is shown here. And this is in angstroms. So those iron spheres are getting very, very small. I should recognize the initiative of Neil Armstrong in this case. Every time I see 10084, I think of that he sort of, he at the last minute looked at a rock box filled with a number of very nicely selected samples that he had gathered, and decided that he'd just fill it up with dirt. And that's 10084. Thank God he did, because that's still our best regolith sample. It gives us an extraordinary resource to use, and it's one which I hope this conference will recommend very strongly to NASA, that is distributed far more widely so that we can get more experience with lunar samples. If you really got a program now that's going to take you back to the moon, we'll get some more. We don't need to save everything we have. The nanophase iron is in vapor deposit patinas, rims, on virtually all grains in a mature Mars soil, and particularly on the small grains. It is a major part of the reason why you see these increased values with a decrease in grain size. Next slide. Here's a plagioclase crystal. Plagioclase has no iron, significant iron in it at all. And here you see the spots of iron within the rim of glass, of silica-rich glass, deposited on that plagioclase grain. Next. Similarly, you see it in multiple layers sometimes. Here are two layers here, a thicker layer in here. Now that's an agglutinated glass. Next. Just thought I'd throw in one of my samples into this. This was a large vesicle. This is a centimeter scale up here, a large vesicle in a rocket station 6. It was a vesicular impact generator breccia, or rock composed of fragments of other rock, highly vesicular, and there was one very large vesicle in that rock that shows that patina gradually fading out as you get deeper and deeper into the vesicle. This is the nanophase iron-rich patina. Now, I say at least 800,000 years. We have an exposure age when that boulder arrived at its current resting place, having rolled about a kilometer and a half down the North Massif in the Valley of Taurus Littrow. But I don't know how it was exposed in the source crop or outcrop from which it came. So that developed at least in 800,000 years, may have been exposed there and developed a much longer period of time. We really don't have a good handle on how fast these patinas are developing. Next slide. Next. The magnetic susceptibility of soil particles increases as grain size decreases. Next. The effects of this vapor deposit nanophase iron are a direct function of surface area and most pronounced in the finest grain sizes. Next. And this is the important point. Virtually all of the 10 micron or less particles are easily attracted with a simple hand magnet. All of them. That's a tool. Next. Of course, we have to address these dust issues before any commercial or any other presence can be on the moon can be fully evaluated. Next slide. Next. There's the potential for dust coatings on seals, gaskets, optical lenses, windows, electrical components, and so forth. Abrasiveness with regards to friction-bearing surfaces. Potential for settling on all thermal and optical surfaces. And the physiological effects on humans. Those not only include the lungs, but it was the very ultrafine particles migration into other body organs. Solutions. Dust lock clearly has to exist on all habitats. Magnetic brushes may work for some cleaning, although it would be nice to have that done automatically with something like an electrostatic repulsion system on critical fabrics and designs. And you just, by engineering design, you seal it out of the critical environment. You just don't let it get into where it's going to cause a problem. Human exposure to lunar dust. On Apollo 11, there were two inhalations. Apollo 12 and 14, three. And the final three missions had four. Now that's taking your helmet off after each EVA, and then when you go weightless during ascent, at the end of ascent, you get the dust that is accumulated in the on the floorboards or under the floorboards of the lunar module. That is momentarily suspended, and you inhale some of that. But the filtering in the Apollo lunar modules was very efficient. All of that dust ended up in the lithium hydroxide canisters, and after only a few minutes, I'd have to go back to the transcripts and see if you can pin that down, but not very long, any sign of that dust, smell or otherwise, was gone. What are the physiological effects? Well, you had that spent gunpowder smell, lasted a minute or two. Particularly after the each EVA, I do not recall, and again I have to go back, and maybe I mentioned it in the transcripts. And by the way, a great resource, of course, is Eric Jones's Apollo Lunar Surface Science Journal. It's the edited and annotated transcripts, a complete transcript for lunar surface activities. It's on the web. You haven't ever encountered it, it's a great resource for all of us. And there's a lot of other stuff in it besides just the transcripts now. He has a team of hundreds of people, I think, around the world contributing to that webpage. I do not recall that there was any gunpowder smell after ascent, as if all of the unsatisfied electron bonds had been satisfied by the oxygen spacecraft atmosphere. Short-term nasal irritation, relatively brief hay fever symptoms that I had. Not everybody seems to have reported them. Mine were pronounced. I had been exposed long enough to the Houston petrochemical atmosphere that I think I was particularly sensitive to it. Actually, it all goes back to having to do spins in the T-37 with a cold while I was in pilot training. That was the wrong thing to do, but I couldn't get a flight surgeon to ground me. When you want them to ground you, they won't do it. The short-term irritation lasted for, gradually went away. By the time I woke up the next morning, it was gone. At the end of the next rest period, it came back a little bit the second time. And by the third excursion, it seemed to have largely disappeared. So, for better or worse, I was adapting to the presence of that dust. No known long-term effects in any of the astronauts. The longitudinal studies, such as they are, that NASA has, and that about two-thirds of us participate in, have shown no long-term effects. But there are really no specific investigations. This has not been an issue for NASA biomedical research. And indeed, in spite of efforts for over 10 or 15 years to get NASA to work with local jurisdictions to have to be able to autopsy lunar astronauts as they leave this veil, that has not been done. Now, I don't think they're going to find anything, but it's a data point. You ought to have it. And there ought to be a specific consideration of what such an autopsy ought to look for and where it ought to look. Terrible subject, but it's one. Now, some of this stuff will be covered, I hope, later this year in a book, in the context of the book that Praxis, I hope, will publish. Now, but before we go away from this, I had a discussion with Russ last night. I've heard it twice again this morning. This suit was not dysfunctional. For 3 days, it worked essentially exactly as it was designed to work. It wasn't a great suit. There were a lot of problems with it. We'll talk about that in the discussion. But it was not dysfunctional. There was no change in the leak rate of any significance in that suit through 3 EVAs. Or when we suited up for ASCENT. Now, when you looked at the bearings, the wrist bearings, yeah, there were scratches, but they're circumferential scratches. There was no pathway across those bearings, either the neck bearing or the wrist bearing. Now, would it have worked for 100 cycles? No, almost certainly it wouldn't. It's not the suit you want for long-term exploration and operations on the moon. But don't think of the A7LB as a dysfunctional suit. Because if you start to do that, then you're going to miss some of the lessons that are there that it has to teach you about abrasion and about particularly the fabric accumulation of fine dust and the event. And we wasted a lot of time at the end of each EVA trying to brush that dust off the suits. It was already in the suits. And all we succeeded in doing is further wearing out our forearms. The number one problem with that suit are the gloves. If you had that suit and a glove that allowed normal human dexterity, that would be fine for future exploration of the moon. Now, there are a lot of other improvements we can make. It needs to be less massive, it needs to be more mobile in many ways. But I could run at 10 kilometers an hour in that suit through a boulder field. And there's a video of that on the third excursion. That was not a problem. That kind of mobility was a problem. It was too heavy. It took energy to use. There were all sorts of restrictions on how to use it. The worst thing, the thing we haven't fixed yet, even in the shuttle suits, it's probably worse, because you're working at a higher pressure, is that glove. That's got to be fixed. Not the subject of this conference, but if you're worried about biomedical issues, getting those forearms fatigued as they were for all the Apollo astronauts is a dangerous thing to do. Because when you need the muscle power, you won't have it. Okay, any questions? I think that's it. Yes, sir.
That one rock that you showed that you brought back, that was a meteorite?
No. That was a piece of the big boulder that rolled down the North Massif. Oh. That boulder was a huge thing. I don't know whether you've seen that picture or not. It's fairly commonly shown, and I should have had it with that. But it's a boulder with two types of what we call impact breccia that had been almost certainly generated by the huge event that created the Surinatatis Basin, that about 3.85 billion years ago. And that basin's 240 kilometers in diameter, so it was an event of some significance on the moon. And it generated two types of these rocks composed of fragments of other rocks that are welded together. One doesn't show any signs, significant signs of melting. The other shows signs of extensive melting, and that's the vesicular rock, the rock with the holes in it. And the latter intruded the former. You can see that contact in the boulder. It's really interesting geology. So that was part of something that actually happened on the moon about 3.8 billion years ago. Yes?
There were reports on the Apollo 12 suit that there was some loss of pressure after EVA. Was there something that was done that you did that they didn't do, or was it?
Well, I don't recall those reports. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. I know that we had the last three missions, the two I trained for, 15 and 17, we had a procedure to wipe, to clean the bearings. We had some wipes that we used on the bearings and the zippers. And who knows how effective that was, but we did it.
Yeah.
And it made help. But it also was a different suit. The A7LB was flown only on 15, 16, and 17. So it was an improved suit. Now, you'd have to go back into the history and see what was fixed, what was improved, and whether that might have had an effect on that. I had not recalled that Apollo 12 had some increase in leak rate, but it wouldn't surprise me if they did, since there was that abrasion taking place. But the only thing I could see when I visually looked at it was the circumferential abrasion. I didn't see any cross fractures, and the suit checks didn't indicate any loss of any significant leak. Yes?
Did you
see any dust inside the helmet? No. We cleaned them, put an anti-fog material on the inside of the helmet. There was dust on the outside of the helmet, and we cleaned that off. And it was attracted electrostatically, I think, to the Lexan of the helmet. One of the reasons I did a lot of work with my sun visor up to about here was because of dust accumulation on it. I could still see through it. It wasn't a big problem. It didn't say problem, but I could just see a little bit better through the clear Lexan of the helmet itself than I could through the gold-plated visor that was we had on the front. That was a UV-protecting gold plate. Yes?
When you were back into the habitat, did you feel like there was a lot of
Were there particles in the habitat that we had tracked in and were suspended? They weren't suspended. They were temporarily suspended. They were all spilling out. In 1/6 gravity environment, they all ended up down on the floorboard or below it. The floorboard had holes in it for that to happen. But when you even that several minutes after we had, and again the timeline you can get from the transcripts. That Eric Jones has on his website. But it would be a number of minutes after we were inside and repressurized that we took the helmets off. Now the repressurization process would have kept some of the finer dust particles suspended and circulating. But when you took your helmet off, you could still smell it. I don't recall seeing it so much as just smelling the finer particles. There might be comments in the transcripts that would clarify that. I did not have time to go back and look at that for this presentation. Yes?
Along those same lines, did you ever notice any eye irritation after you were
that? Did I notice any eye irritation? No, I never did. And I don't recall Cernan or anybody else commenting on eye irritation. Yes?
Was there evidence, I guess, of volcanic eruptions on the moon?
The orange and green pyroclastic glasses and all these little beads of glass, the nicely spherical beads that I showed in that picture, in all lunar soils are strong evidence of pyroclastic volcanic eruptions. Most of them post the Mare Basalt eruptions in the region in which they're found. In fact, they're probably, we don't know whether there were pyroclastic eruptions during the Mare Basalt episodes because they were covered. And in fact, the reason we found the orange soil in a pure form, an orange soil that is probably at least 3.5 billion years old, is that, and probably closer to 3.8, is that it was covered by a basalt flow and protected through that period of time. Otherwise, we'd never seen it. It would have been mixed with the regular. But we found an actual deposit of pure orange glass. And that just seeing anything like that in the lunar regolith is very surprising because of that mixing process that's taken place over almost 4 billion years. Yes, sir?
Jack, for the purposes of this workshop, what should we be paying attention to? What should we absolutely not miss? About biological effects of lunar dust.
What should we not miss relative to the biological effects? Number one, we need to understand what those effects are, because there's always the possibility that our engineering might fail. Secondly, though, I think we need to look at what are the preventive measures that engineering can take in order to minimize the level of exposure, the dose level that anyone would have to ultrafine particles. I'm not worried about the fine particles. The human anatomy has evolved over millions of years, really you probably say hundreds of million years, all anatomy has evolved so that we protect ourselves from dust. Naturally generated dust on Earth, with very few exceptions, we protect ourselves. We clear our lungs. As long as you don't smoke, you're probably okay. You get to the ultrafine particles, as was mentioned in the introduction, those are primarily generated by, unless they're chemical aerosols, are primarily generated by human activity. The moon is different. The moon naturally generates its own ultrafine particles. And so we really do need to understand the biological effects of those particles. But simultaneously, we need to be looking at what are reasonable and effective means of preventing dust from being a problem. And that's an engineering challenge. So I think your conference really has to integrate those two. You understand what the biomedical, the occupational health problem is relative to dust. Secondly, as we do here on Earth, we need to figure out how to take prophylactic measures to prevent it being a problem. And that's not going to be easy. In fact, frankly, dust is your number one environmental problem on the moon. Radiation, you know how to deal with that. I don't think that radiation is an issue. Again, it's something you need to understand, but you've got plenty of radiation protection in the regolith. You bury your habitats, or you explosively generate protective shelters that you can put the rover over as a roof if you're out away from your habitats. There are just all sorts of ways to deal with radiation. I don't know all the answers yet of how you deal with dust. I'm confident we'll figure them out. But having the experience of going into a dust lock, namely the lunar module, and trapping all the dust in there, I can see how it's going to be hard then to have another lock and keep dust out. So somehow the engineering design and the operational philosophy of your habitats has to be to keep all the dust in the dust lock. Keep as much of it as you can outside through electrostatic repulsion, magnetic pressures, whatever else you use. But you're going to have some of it come into the initial entrance to the habitat. And how do you keep all of it in there? Or scrub it out before you go into the other part of the habitat. Even having said that, you want to design what's in the primary habitat so that it's not affected by dust. Because you know you're going to get some in there. It's going to be awfully hard to prevent. I hope we figure out a way to keep it from happening, but I think you have to anticipate that some dust will migrate in. Back there, now come back.
Do you recall the use of simulated dust to develop a suit?
My recollection, somebody may be able to correct me on that, we didn't. The suit design did not, and test did not include simulated dust. I have no. Huh? Did it? Did they actually work the bearings and stuff in a dust and mud? They did? How much do I know? Not much on that subject. I didn't recall that those tests were done. All I recall is that they were sewn together by people at International Latex Corporation in Dover, Delaware. It was one of the more interesting experiences of my time to go there for a suit fit and see all these sewing machines and women working at the sewing machines who had just a few months before been making ladies' undergarments. They were sewing the suits together. And that's how they were built. And they were very good suits. They really worked extremely well for the purposes to which we put them. Yes?
There were some thermal vacuum tests and some analyses on the thermal effects of the dust, the changes in the absorptivity and emissivity.
Yes, that's a good point. I mean, I was aware of. They did do those kind of tests. We had 7 layers of aluminized mylars, primary thermal protection, over a rubber bladder. And then there was Nomex-like fabric covering the suit. And then on the gloves, where most of the wear would take place, we had a cover glove of with a metallic fabric as a protector. And I'm not sure what type of metallic fabric that was.
Chromel.
And they wore pretty. If you want to see the effects of abrasion, go look at the Smithsonian gloves. The gloves they have in the Smithsonian, they're pretty badly worn. That dust is extremely abrasive. I should mention also, just as an example, of what happens if you don't seal a working bearing. By the start of the third excursion, what we call our extension handle, which was mated to a variety of tools, that was non-functional. That mate was non-functional. It was just jammed because of the dust. So, but on the other side, the rover bearings apparently never had a problem. I mean, there was never any indication that the rover bearings were affected by dust at all. They were sealed and apparently had no problem. Yes, sir.
There's been some discussion for years that there's on the photoelectron sheet on the moon. Do you see any areas of that floating?
The first answer is no, and the second answer is yes. The first answer is that working during on the lunar surface, we saw no evidence of it. And the only evidence really I think there is of that are the Vidicon pictures taken by the Surveyor craft at sunset, I believe, because it wouldn't have normally taken pictures at sunrise, and there's a haze on the horizon. And has been interpreted as some kind of a photoelectric effect that has levitated some dust. We may have been able to see that from lunar orbit, again at sunrise, on the horizon, just at sunrise. We reported and actually sketched in our flight plan what appeared to be a horizon glow. And it may again be that. But it looks like it's probably just a temporary effect. There was no... Nothing would the lunar vacuum, where when we were working there, in whatever direction you looked, anything you did, was absolutely clear. It was starkly clear. There was no indication that of sun going through dust particles. So I don't think levitation was occurring. I think the eye has a high enough dynamic range that you would have seen that. If it was occurring during the day. But at sunrise, sunset, there may be a phenomenon there that needs to be explained. Another point of evidence, though, is that if it is something that's happening, it's not getting into the corner cube reflectors we left up there in a recognizable way, because there has been no degradation in their return in now over 30 years. You might, though, verify that with McDonald Observatory people. But I've never seen any degradation reported. I've talked to them a few years ago, and they hadn't seen it. David, you heard any indication?
I thought there was a few percent.
Oh, has it? Well, then we need to verify that.
Yeah.
Because that if there has been a few percent, it can come from two sources. One, micrometeorites, putting dust in there or some kind of levitation process. But that would be a good day to point. I had not heard that it was an air issue.
That's what I heard, but be sure and verify.
And they just installed a brand new laser at McDonald, much higher sensitivity, and so they may be collecting data that will be important to us. Just. Well, it's just the, all you have to do is go look at the videos. You didn't worry much about it. And on the first EVA, we took some, we were adapting to gravity again. But that happened very quickly. That's one of the reasons I think that a little bit of gravity is going to be a great help to preventing any kind of performance issues. And that later EVAs, when we fell, I think it was because we just become so confident and so unworried about it that we worked dynamically enough that occasionally you get your center of gravity off a little bit. It was not in a familiar place, by the way. The center of gravity was offset about 2 inches, I recall, towards your back. And that's one reason why when Charlie Duke on Apollo 16 was going to demonstrate how high he could jump in front of the camera, he forgot to jump through his center of gravity. And he rotated out of the picture. Landed on his back. One other aspect of it is that you learn very quickly to operate in a dynamic stability. You're moving all the time because you're trying to, in that 1/6 gravity, I think, just instinctively you're trying to keep track of where that center of gravity is. But once you get used to it, like I say, running. Particularly with a cross-country skiing technique, is very easy and very fast and very efficient. It's too bad we didn't take the astronauts out and train them in cross-country skiing, because there was without that technique, there was a tendency to do this bunny hop, and that's not a very efficient way to move across the surface. Yes?
I have a few questions. One was, how long were you on the surface? Second one was, how bright were the reflections? I've heard that it was really bright. And third was, how effective were the gold shields that you guys had? Would you recommend those? In the
future? Okay, we were outside the spacecraft for a little over 22 hours, three different excursions, 7.5 hours apiece. The surface was bright, but not so bright as to say be any worse than a. No worse than a desert on Earth, a bright sunny day on the desert, and certainly not as bad as a snowfield on a bright sunny day. Although the optical properties on the surface are not unlike snow, in that you have a very high backscatter. When you look down sun, look at your shadow, you have a high backscatter, just like fresh snow. You have good light even in the shadows. Because of that backscatter, you get light into the shadows, and you can use your suit as a reflector. You just move it a little bit just to get light into the shadows. So, auxiliary light in the shadows might be nice to have in certain during the daytime, certainly at night you want it. But we weren't inhibited in looking into the shadows at all. What was the other?
The gold shield.
The gold shield was principally for UV protection, and it probably attenuated a little bit of light. I don't know, the measurements are probably available somewhere. I hope they are. My guess is that maybe 10% of the light was, of the visible light was lost.
One problem I've always been concerned about, if you're at one of the polar regions, the sun, if you're in a sunlit area, is essentially always going to be on the horizon.
Yeah.
And looking down sun, can you see anything right at the sun?
Oh, looking into the sun?
Yeah, towards the sun.
Oh, no. You can. We were really only exposed to that. The first EVA, the sun was at about, 20 degrees, something like that, 16 to 20. And it was not comfortable to look back into the sun, and you didn't do it, just like you don't do it in this when you're normally operating here on Earth.
But it would be much worse at the poles.
It would be worse. You bring up a good point. It would be worse at the poles. And also you would have less light coming back as backscattering, too, just because the zero phase point would be way off, away from it. Good thought. Did I get them all? Yeah, I think so.
Thank you.
Some.
You suggested to do a combination process in high value. What are we looking for?
I suggested that we try to do a combination of, and I would use real lunar material in a high vacuum, very high vacuum. What you're want to do is be able to set up some experiments, maintain that vacuum on the material that answer questions of what are the in situ properties of the lunar soil. Because we can't answer those questions with lunar soil we have back on Earth. No vacuum seal was maintained, at least not on the rock boxes. I don't know whether all the little special sample containers have been opened yet or not. But as far as I know, no indium knife edge seal maintained its vacuum.
Carl, are there any samples still in vacuum?
There are not any samples that are still maintained in the lunar vacuum. There are two unopened core tubes that they've certainly been in a nitrogen environment for 30 years.
But all of the special, so-called, what are they called, special sample containers, those little ones?
Yeah.
They've been opened?
Those are all been opened, yeah.
Okay, so. But the rock boxes were designed for 10 to the minus 6, I believe, maintain at least that vacuum. And my understanding is when they were tested in the lunar receiving laboratory, they had all lost that vacuum. It's basically an atmospheric pressure. As we talked a little bit last night at dinner, the lunar samples essentially all were exposed to some kind of an atmosphere from the time that they entered the spacecraft on the moon to the time that they were not nitrogen atmosphere, or at least not pure dry nitrogen atmosphere, until they were opened or mated into the lunar receiving laboratory. So there's quite an extended period of exposure to Earth, a variety of Earth environments during that period of time. So I really think that it would be important to, first of all, decide what are the measurements you'd like to make in situ on the lunar surface, and then set up a high vacuum chamber where you can grind previously dried lunar material. You want to get as much of the gas out of it as you possibly can before you introduce it and start to try to grind it. And now, remembering that the one thing you won't have in that material is these nanophase iron containing the patinas, glass patinas on the particles. And I don't know how you're going to create a simulant of that. Maybe some people, there are always bright people with great ideas, and maybe somebody will. That's it.
Thank you
very much.